This audio program is brought to you courtesy of Audible.com. Audible, audio that speaks to you wherever you are.
BBC Audiobooks and Testbed Productions present Four Treats for Language Lovers, Fry's English Delight, with Stephen Fry. Part 1. Stephen Fry endures some linguistic punishment with an investigation into the use of puns.
So, now then, Fry, set the tone. Restraint. Always restraint. There's going to be no dreadful wordplay in my opening, as it were. I shall start as I mean to go on. This is proper. This is British Radio 4, the only station which has a programme especially for angry people with bladder problems, cross incontinence. Damn, I couldn't hold it in, I'm so sorry. But puns are as British, English perhaps, as a punnet of strawberries at Wimbledon, a punt on the can. Corporal Punnett, no, we will not be seduced by the cheap and the tawdry. Not yet, anyway. This programme attempts to understand why our language and culture groans with the weight of punniness. Newspaper headlines, radio and TV programmes, shops and businesses, commercial products. But what is a pun, exactly? I hear you ask, prompted by these my teasing introductory words. A pun, if I may answer you somewhat portentously, is a figure of speech, paronomasia, consisting of a deliberate confusion of similar words or phrases for rhetorical effect, often with humorous intent. To start with, there are simple homographic and homophonic puns. Homographic puns exploit the difference in meaning of words which look alike and usually sound alike. Mr. Arthur Smith will illustrate.
What must you know to be an auctioneer? Lots.
Homophonic puns exploit the difference in meanings of words which sound alike but have different spellings.
I've no idea how worms reproduce, but you often find them in pairs.
A pun can rely on different shades of meaning of one word, polysemy, or the assumed equivalence of multiple similar words, homonymy, or of a literal meaning with a metaphor.
Why did the Marxist only drink herbal tea? Because proper tea is theft.
As I always say, show me where Trotsky's buried and I'll show you a communist plot. In short, the man who treats a homonym as a synonym has a pun in him. Shall we concern ourselves further also with the heteronymic? Shall we debate whether the phenomenon also bears scrutiny as a form of antanaklesis and polypteton? Or ask where dissonance ends and a pun begins? No, we shall not. Nor shall we even consider literary puns, which would be a programme of its own. Enough. Although, the word pun itself is believed to be originally a contraction of puntigrion, an archaic term thought to have originated from punctilius, which itself derived from the Italian puntilio, originally meaning a fine point, diminutive of punto, point, from the Latin punctus, past participle of pungere, to prick. It may sound impressive, but these etymological sources are reported in the Oxford English Dictionary as mere conjecture. No one really knows. What I can tell you with some certainty is that we're going to hear a lot of pricks over the course of the next 25 minutes or so. With whom shall we start? Preferably someone who will not take offence at such a facetious description. We British are trained in puns from an early age. Who amongst us has not had experience from earliest childhood of the joke inside the Christmas cracker? It's as much a part of the festive season as turkey and mince pies, holly and mistletoe, and a lack of snow on the roof of the London Meteorological Office. In 2006, Professor Richard Wiseman of the University of Hertfordshire conducted a survey on cracker jokes through the Daily Telegraph, so he's a most appropriate pundit to whom we can turn.
One of the things we found out straight away is that Christmas cracker jokes really are not very funny at all. So we had, in fact, 65% of our participants never once ticked the yes, this is a funny gag box. So we're really talking about a series of alleged jokes that aren't funny, which is a kind of weird category of joke.
So why, one may pertinently ask, do we persist in doing it?
I think that is a really interesting question. Why it is that this tradition would survive so long when it doesn't make people laugh? Clearly, it's nothing to do with the laughter. I suspect what's happening is that you have a shared experience around the table. that everyone's sitting there, somebody tells a joke, and the nature of the psychology of humour is that any joke will make some people laugh and not others, which isn't a shared experience, isn't a bonding experience. But if you tell a bad joke, everyone groans. We're all in it together. And it also takes the pressure off the joke teller. If you've got a good joke, you tell it badly, everyone goes, oh, you just messed that up, and you feel bad at the sort of family table. You've got a bad joke in your hand, you can't tell it badly. It's a bad joke. If no one responds, no one laughs, you blame the piece of paper, not yourself. So I think there's interesting social psychology.
That would also explain why so many cracker jokes take the form they do, a question, inviting the others to participate in hazarding a guess and an answer that we can all groan at. Dr. Wiseman, as is fitting, has a pungent observation on why this appeals to us British.
I suspect what's going on is that it's a weird British celebration of failure. That the Americans, who, for example, don't have the cracker tradition at all, I spoke about results on American radio, and they couldn't get their head around the idea of a joke that didn't work. And they were fascinated by that. And the host kept coming back and saying, no, let me get this right. You've got jokes that aren't funny, and you all sit around telling them. I said, that's right, that's the tradition. Why would you do that? He was completely perplexed. I think it's about the Brits kind of going, it's all right to fail. Failure is a bonding exercise. We're all in it together. We're not about picking out one person around the table and going, you're the best, you know, you're the successful person we're all going to look up to. It's this rather weird British celebration of failure.
The first mottos that appeared in the first crackers in the 1860s were not punny at all. They were more an inspirational thought or romantic ditty. Half a century would pass before jokes began to infiltrate, as Peter Kimpton, a crackers historian, literally, and former crackers executive, explains.
They were very inventive at following the trends of the day. So whatever was popular, they would produce a box of crackers which reflected that particular theme. I have one here, 1925-26, Christmas motoring crackers. And crackers for golfers, you have so on. In your sweet click, I long to be. Is my desire in vain? Rather than drive me from your tea, oh, put me out of pain. It's coming in, 1925-26. You have one here called All Sports, a box which features pictures on the lid of cricket, hockey, swimming, rugby, etc., tennis. I'm not the sort to miss a catch, as you will soon discover. I don't intend to lose the match. You've bowled this maiden over. From just a very few years ago, what's the oldest fruit of all? Elderberries. What do you call a man down in the mouth? A dentist. Terrible. Terrible. What kind of tie does a pig wear? A pig's tie.
And from where have the cracker manufacturers traditionally found their puns? Have they employed professional punsters, out-of-work stand-up artists, very annoying brothers-in-law? Punt and Dennis. Well, for many years, Britain's biggest cracker manufacturers followed the time-honoured tradition of the second-rate comedian and stole them. Yes, your cracker manufacturer is the thief of bad gags.
In my day, the product manager would sometimes refer to a book of jokes because you can't really register a joke as your own. It's a peculiar thing. Everybody uses them. The jokes go round the block, but nobody pays a fee to use them.
Should, however, a pun originator be tempted to start proceedings for breach of copyright, he would doubtless turn to the legendary Messrs. Sue, Grabbit and Run, a practice which brings us neatly to the book which arguably contains more puns than any other, The Yellow Pages. Dr. Frank Monaghan of the Open University conducts a survey of business names for Yell.com and discovered that certain occupations display a peculiar propensity for choosing punning names.
Hairdressers are the most groan-worthy ones, of course. There were things like Jack the Snipper, Fat Boy Trim, Curl Up and Die. There was one that's slightly risque. It's called A Bit Off the Top, which actually is a topless hairdresser's up in Paisley. There was Hair Flick. So and even within this, you begin to see certain things. So you get references to TV programmes, Hair Flick, hello, hello. So you get other cultural references that come through the puns as well.
The other great offenders are fish and chip shops, a complete battery of them.
Things like Battersea Cod's Home, which bizarrely is actually in Yorkshire, Rock and Soul Place, Northern Soul. My favourite one, I have to say, is one in Wales called A Fish Called Rhonda, The Godfather, and there's another one called Goodbye, Mr. Chips, B-U-Y, Mr. Chips, which is in Repton, and that's the home of a public school, and so there's a little reference there. Whether there's any record of Robert Donat taking the lower six down to buy fish and chips, I don't know, but they seem to enjoy having that as part of their name.
There was once an employment agency in northwest London called Big Jobs, although it went out of business, and the habit of punning business names seems to be concentrated in a certain kind of trade.
It tends to be largely around services, though, I must say, so that you will get things like gardening shops, petal pushers is one, gardening services, there's a very nice one called Mud, Sweat and Shears we came across, one called The Lawn Ranger. There was a shop called Ello Flower, which is in Yorkshire. So again, you've got a linguistic thing going on there that's there. And there was a nice tree pruning one called The Tree Amigos. And again, that's another film reference, so that may or may not survive as time goes on. Food shops are another source of them. You get, there's one, I think it is in Birmingham, called Baghetti Junction. An interesting Indian restaurant called the Korma Sutra. And there was another, a plumbing company called Bodgett and Scarpa. So they're relying on people's sense of humour, but, you know, there's this whole subgenre, I think, where the negative associations are made, and you wonder how popular they will be. So there's, for example, there's a house clearance company called Klepto and Son. My favourite one in that classification was a drainage company called Success. So we can only speculate, really, that what it does do is it gives you, you know, an instant recognition. People may be struck by the humour of it, and they will then remember it.
But we can't groan with pleasurably feigned exasperation unless we have a stern, disapproving voice telling us how naughty we are even to entertain the notion. Listen to John Humphreys on the Today programme the day after the 2007 budget.
And the time now is 23 minutes to 8, and if you dislike puns, you'd better look away now or possibly switch off. On no account buy the newspapers this morning, because they're full of them, mostly centred on this idea of the 2P. We have reasons 2P cheerful, is what the Sun says. The Daily Mail has a different play on puns, really. What God giveth, God taketh away. Rather a nice line on the front page of the Daily Mail.
The Independent tries to top the puns with 2P or not 2P.
The tabloid newspaper headline is, of course, the perfect format, haiku-like in impact and brevity. Anthony Clavain is chief sports writer of the Sunday Mirror. Let him remind us of the sports headline writer's finest, but not briefest, achievement. In a cup match in 2000, the mighty Glasgow football team Celtic had been beaten 3-1 at home by the lowly Caledonian Thistle side. And the headline the next day?
Super Cali go ballistic. Celtic are atrocious. That is the legendary headline of all time. But I'm sure that the person who wrote that was waiting for years and years and years before he had the chance. We know that readers will remember the great punning headlines. This is the great sort of myth, really. I'd like to claim that the writers write the headlines and write the puns, but sadly we don't.
It is, of course, the unnamed sub-editors who are these unsung literary giants.
I suppose this is the art of the pun, isn't it? Trying to, in one word, say something funny, come up with some kind of wordplay which summarises a mood, a match, a moment. I think that the reward is that they are known amongst their peers as a fine headline writer, a fine punster. There are awards now in many sports journalist awards, which include the category, you know, headline of the year. So those headline writers are now beginning, I think, very belatedly to be recognised.
Talking of newspaper puns reminds me of a man who entered a local paper's pun contest. He sent in 10 different puns in the hope that at least one of the puns would win. Unfortunately, no pun in 10 did. No pun intended, oh dear. Anthony Clavain reminds us of other dangers inherent in the practice.
Rodney Marsh found that out when he made this pun after the tsunami had occurred, and he managed to compare the tsunami to the Newcastle United fans, who are known as the Toon Army. Because he made that pun so close to the tragedy of the tsunami, Sky sacked him. So, you know, punning can be bad for your health.
What is good for your health is laughter. The best medicine, as that famous gardening magazine, The Weeder's Digest, used to have it. And someone providing that medicine in regular doses is Tim Vine, the stand-up comedian.
I like short jokes, personally, and it just so happens that puns and wordplay fit quite well into the short joke thing. So if I go, Black Beauty, he's a dark horse, or if I say, I never sleep with fish, I'm halibut, it's all over and done very, very quickly, and we can move on to the next thing. So people can, if they don't like it, here comes another one, it's not the long lead-up. So it just happens. I don't like puns, really. It's just that puns happen to be, it's work better if they're short. I read in the newspaper the other day, in the obituary column, it said Mars bar, packet of Rolos, double decker. Then I realised, in fact, I was reading the obituary column. Now that's that's the kind of thing I like. I mean, I do you know that there are all male tennis players are witches? For example, Goran, even he's a witch.
But does he see this as a particularly British tradition?
I think the British do have an affinity for this sort of humour. I mean, look at the Carry On films, of course, they're absolutely full of them all. Why are there snakes on your windscreen? Those are my vipers. The great Frankie Howard joke in Carry On Up the Jungle, or whatever it was. And I think it is just because we were the first people to have the English language, so we've played with it for the longest. I know that in France they have puns. I do know one French pun that apparently is done quite a lot. When someone says, I'll see you tomorrow, and they go, demain, they often hold up both hands. They go, demain, as in two hands. It's not hilarious, which is why you don't have carry-on films in France.
Tim Vine tours with a one-man show called Current Puns. So for him, it's compulsive then, is it, this urge to turn everything into a pun?
Yes. It does become a bit excessive that everywhere you look, you see a sign. And, like I was in a shop the other day and I saw the sign said menswear, and I saw it as men swear, and you do begin to see things. Or you see lavatories. I saw it as lavatories, and I imagined all these conservatives in volcanoes. And I've tried all these things on stage. Not all of them work. Apparently, I found out recently that if you suffer from the compulsive punning, you're a paranomasiac. Yes, I think I must be. I certainly am in bouts.
The trouble with miniaturisation, in humour as in anything else, is that very small things are easy to purloin, and at least two people have been accused of nicking Tim Vine's jokes, making them, I suppose, a pair of knickers.
People sometimes say to me, am I flattered having my jokes endlessly stolen? It's a bit like saying to someone, that burglar must have really liked your DVD player to steal it. I mean, that must count for something. Well, not really, no. I suppose it is slightly flattering. And strangely enough, when these things do end up floating around the internet for a length of time, you actually feel slightly less ownership of them, which is sad because they do belong to me. But that's one of those things, The key is to keep writing. You keep writing and people keep nicking it. That's the trouble. There's too many people out there who can't be bothered to write jokes. My sister made up this one. I was getting into my car. This bloke said to me, can you give me a lift? I said, sure, you look great. The world's your oyster, go for it. My sister made that one. And then, of course, this one's definitely mine. I went to the butcher. He said, I bet you £10 you can't reach those two bits of meat. He said, I'm pointing upwards, by the way. I said, I'm not betting. He said, why not? I said, the stakes are too high.
In 2004, Tim Vine's joke writing skills led him to breaking the Guinness World Record for the most jokes told in an hour. 499 rib-tickling quickie quips, which works out, to those of you who may be government officials, as more than 8.3166 laughs a minute. Others of us can only let fall our jaws and admire a veritable joke machine, the very thought of which might strike one as oxymoronic. But if it did, banish such thoughts. Such a thing actually exists, dear listener, and if Tim Vine can rattle out more than 8 a minute, this joke machine can punish him with more than 10 times that amount, some 5,000 puns an hour. It is called stand-up.
Please wait while I think of a joke. Why is a majestic field different from a gaudy shrimp?
Why is a majestic field different from a gaudy shrimp?
One is a proud lawn, the other is a loud prawn.
One is a proud lawn, the other is a loud prawn.
The human voice there belongs to Dr. Graham Ritchie, Senior Research Fellow at Aberdeen University, who is one of the team from three Scottish universities who worked on stand-up, which is an acronym for System to Augment Non-Speakers Dialogue Using Puns. Dr. Ritchie explains its origins.
Certain children are very limited in their ability to play with language if they've suffered from something like cerebral palsy or some kind of accident which has impaired their speech abilities or their motor coordination. Children like that very often communicate with the world through a speech synthesizer in a very laborious way. So it makes it very difficult for them to play with puns and jokes with their friends. So we thought if we gave them a computer that could make puns and that they could control, that would give them a playmate and it would help them to explore language, find out about words meaning the same and sounding the same and so on.
Although the machine might be prolific, it doesn't do it quite as we humans do it.
I think it's quite hard to draw any comparison between this program and how humans do it. We have just built the model in a way which would appear to work. In other words, we've done it from linguistic information rather than psychological information. We've looked at the structure of these jokes to see what the linguistic relations are between the words and phrases. And then we've devised rules which are faithful to those patterns of linguistic relations. Now, there's no notion that this simulates how people think these things up. And I don't think there's much evidence about how people think these things up. Despite having thought them up myself, it's very hard to introspect and know how you've thought them up. Any kind of joke which can be constructed using ambiguity can be done by using phonetic similarity as the route to achieve the ambiguity. So some people would say these are puns, some people might say they're not puns because they are more broadly ambiguity-based jokes. A couple of parrots are sitting on a perch. One says to the other, "Can you smell fish?"
So what does make one joke better than another?
I don't know the psychological literature on reaction to puns. I do know of one study where the researchers asked people to rate a number of puns for how funny they were. However, it was only one study and it was very narrow because it only looked at one class of pun known as the Tom Swifty, which is a one-line pun in which you attribute some remark to a character called Tom and then you add an adverb about how he said it, and there's a pun across between the adverb and what was said. So, for example, "Turn up the heat," said Tom coldly. Or, "I don't know what to buy in the supermarket," said Tom listlessly. Now, those were the kinds that they looked at, and depending on how complex your words are, you can get more than one link across between elements in the text, and they found that the more links, the funnier people found them. But it's very hard to generalise that to anything beyond that kind of joke.
But perhaps the existence of artificial intelligence creating scripts with a joke structure can give us an insight into what makes a pun funny. Ah, to attempt to explain that is like trying to grab a handful of fog. We can try, though, where others have only missed. Missed! Dr. Ritchie first.
There's not much agreement on why these are funny. Various suggestions have been made. Well, one suggestion is they're not very funny at all. But beyond that, it has been suggested that in a pun you bring together two very disparate ideas and force them together, and so the clash of the ideas results in humour. Alternatively, sometimes you're just very impressed with the cleverness of the pun. So some of the more intricate ones make you laugh because of the ingenuity of the construction.
Tim Vine?
I think the best type of wordplay is the one that creates the most surprise. I suppose most jokes involve some sort of surprise. You're led one way and then suddenly pull back the other way. And so the best ones, I guess, are the ones where in the shortest possible distance you've created the biggest change of direction. I've got a bit of moon rock. When I broke it open, it had moon written all through it.
And Dr. Monaghan?
It's a very cheap form of metaphor, isn't it? It's an attempt to make links between things that are a bit dissonant and actually to make it stick in your mind. So I guess it's what Dryden called them the most grovelling form of wit, didn't he? So it's that level of metaphor, perhaps, that is at work that makes people remember it.
Incongruity, ambivalence, brevity, classic theories of humour, all to be found in such a little thing as a pun. So, simple enough to be replicated by a machine, short enough as to appear insignificant, the lowest form of wit that in the hands of a master can be elevated to magical status. For my own part, for what it's worth, I think the best puns should work on the level of language and on the level of meaning. Like this example. What's the definition of a mistress? Something between a mister and a mattress.
Part 2. Stephen Fry discovers a metaphorical maritime link to the shaping of the English language in this programme about metaphor.
We start at what you might call the throat of the River Thames, a bit upstream from the mouth, with Nigel Rigby, head of research at the National Maritime Museum at Greenwich.
We're standing on the banks of the River Thames, and it's a kind of an overcast day, and the tide's coming in, and maybe 100 years ago, 200 years ago, with the tide coming, you'd had a heck of a lot of ships just sailing up the river, up to the docks in London. It was a very busy port indeed. We've got prints and drawings and photographs from the late 19th century showing the river packed with shipping. It's a sort of maritime heritage. It's supposed to be sort of increasingly invisible to us today. Sea blindness, actually, the maritime industries call it. And my museum's quite bothered about it. But sea deafness, not hearing the sea, gets rather less attention. But if you listen, you'll hear the sea all around you. Just hundreds, if not thousands, of words and expressions in common use today had their origins at sea.
Cock up.
Taken aback.
Show a leg. Now, that's a very good one. And if you stop to think about it, what has that got to do with the sea?
Ah, now, chip on your shoulder is a very interesting one.
And Nigel Rigby's idea of sea deafness and unawareness of the sound of the sea, including sea-related words and phrases, is an interesting one as well. A newly invented metaphor. In fact, you'd be taken aback by how many metaphors are washed ashore on the coastline of meaning by the movement of the sea. Nigel Rigby of the Maritime Museum again.
When we say, I am taken aback, or someone was taken aback, I mean, I was surprised. And that is an old expression from the sailing navy. It is when the wind goes in front of the sail rather than behind it, and so brings the ship to a grinding halt, unplanned. When you are taken aback, it means it happens suddenly. Sudden shift in the wind, or the helmsman hasn't been paying attention, and it can have dire consequences. You can actually dismast a ship doing it that way. You didn't really want to happen.
In other words, a potential cock-up. Here's another maritime historian, Michael Naxton.
Cock-up, well, I mean, I think everybody really knows what it means. Normally, the yards on a ship, and they're the spars that are at right angles to the masts from which the sails hang, they are always straight. It was sometimes done, if there'd been a death on board, to tilt the yards, and they were known when they were in that position as a cockbill. But if they were accidentally left slanting, this was regarded as untidy, sloppy, and generally wrong. And I think there's no doubt that this is where the expression a cock-up comes from. In the days of sail, again, the sailors in the navy always deserted ship when ship was in harbour. So it became accepted practice that when a ship was in harbour, the men who were married could have their women on board to stay with them whilst the ship was tied up at the quayside. And when the bosun came down in the morning to wake the sailors, the cry would go up, "Show a leg." And what it meant was that if the ladies hung one leg out of their hammock, it was obvious for the bosun to see that they were women, and they were allowed to stay in bed for an extra half an hour. So the men got out immediately, but the people who had shown the leg were allowed to stay in bed a little bit longer.
I always thought a cock-up was a printer's error, a sticking-up bit of misplaced type, but we don't want to give anyone a chip on their shoulder. Chip on your shoulder.
It comes out of the naval dockyards, where you had a series of strikes through the 18th century over the right of the dockyard workers to take home logs of wood, chips, as they were called. They had to be a yard long, no more. There was a lot of dispute between the dockyard authorities and the dockyard workers over it, and there were strikes over it, and they forced the dockyard workers to carry these chips on the shoulders to make sure that they were right size and they were only bringing out the right amount.
So that's where the resentment comes in, because the dockyard workers felt resentful at having to display what they considered to be their ancient rights, which is actually, if you go to Portsmouth to this day and you look in some of the old dockyard houses, you'll find their stairs are exactly a yard wide for that very reason.
And a well-worn meteorological favourite, it's cold enough to freeze the balls off a brass monkey. But what was a brass monkey? Michael Naxton, then Nigel Rigby.
Brass monkey was a triangle of brass that used to sit on the ship's deck in which the cannonballs were placed. If you stop to think about it, cannonballs on a warship, perfectly round, you had to keep them in something or they'd go rolling all over the place. Therefore, they were stacked in a nice neat little pyramid. And it used to be thought that this little brass triangle, which was known as the monkey, would, in the depths of winter, get so cold the metal would contract and the cannonballs would fall off and roll all over the deck.
No one in their right minds would put cannonballs on a grid that they could roll off on an open deck in anything like a chop, because a cannonball rolling around a deck could cause serious damage. You know, you could crush a foot or anything like that. So it just strikes me as an absurd derivation, because it just wouldn't ever have existed.
Now, some experts say that actually a brass monkey was a small cannon known as a monkey and always made of brass. But the same principle applied. In very, very cold weather, in the depths of winter, the brass of the cannon contracted and the balls fell out. The cannon balls wouldn't fit properly, so they just fell out.
Monkey is actually used in naval slang. It was a slang term for a spike, really, that was used to lift or lower the gun. That was one expression for it. It was also a slang term for a penis as well. So you can actually see there might conceivably be some sort of link between, you know, penis and balls being broken off. But again, that's not been proven, and it's very hard to prove these things.
Oh dear. It is not the intention of this programme to foment discord between naval historians, nor did we intend any below-the-plimsoll-line references. The point is, many, many marine metaphors have come ashore into our language, and it doesn't matter if we forget where exactly they embarked. It is the case, though, that charting a course towards an understanding of metaphor, of the navel-gazing kind or otherwise, will not be plain sailing.
Plain sailing goes back to, again, about the 17th or 18th century, after something called the Mercator projection was brought in for charts, for maritime charts.
Thank you, Mr. Rigby, but another explanation won't be necessary, and apologies for the interruption, but having established that derivation isn't necessarily a friend to the understanding of metaphor, let us instead travel to an intensely metaphorical place of work, a place where metaphor is central to the very meaning of the enterprise. A poet's pad? A linguist's lair? A lexicographer's loft on Lexington Avenue? No. No, this is, in fact, the North London shopfront of EuroSip, where, in addition to running a Greek language travel agency, Dora Constantinou oversees an international business dealing in removals.
Sorry, yeah.
Which, in Greek, is...
Metaphores. Yes, we transfer, transport. We are dealing with metaphores to different countries, for instance, yes. When you talk to people, what is your occupation? We say for removers, ya metafores, we say. You say metaphoric when you say to somebody, for instance, life is not a bed of roses. Yes, that's a metaphor. Yes? Yes, I suppose it transfers, it carries. It carries from one thing to the other. You carry the meaning. It's like a transport. You carry the item from one place to the other. So you can say, I suppose, it does mean transport, transferred, metaphora, metaphorico. Yes, it has got the same kind of meaning. Metaphores. Yes, we transfer, transport.
A transport, in Mrs. Constantinou's case, of delight. Dr. Guy Deutscher is an Israeli linguist from the University of Leiden in the Netherlands and author of The Unfolding of Language, pleasingly metaphorical title.
In Greece, you can do metaphors between your bank accounts. It simply means you transfer money from one place to another. And removal vans, as you've seen in Greece, are called metaphors because they transfer your furniture. But when we use the word metaphor, we're not talking about transfer of furniture, we're talking about transfer of meaning. We take a concept and transfer it from its original environment to a completely different domain of meaning. Metaphors, certainly of everyday language, almost always move from the concrete to the abstract. Almost always you take a concept from the physical world and you use it to express things that are more abstract or at least more complex.
And we must go to the year 1912 for an illustration, a famous tragedy, a maritime one as it happens.
World's largest metaphor hits iceberg. Titanic, representation of man's hubris, sinks in North Atlantic. 1,500 dead in symbolic tragedy. New York, April 15. Officials of the White Star Line have confirmed the sinking during her maiden voyage of the RMS Titanic, the world's largest symbol of man's mortality and vulnerability.
This is from the somewhat unreliable American publication, The Onion.
The telegraph office of the White Star Line, which owns the nautical archetype. At 4:23 a.m. Greenwich Standard Time, the following message was received from the rescue ship Carpathia. Titanic struck by icy representation of nature's supremacy. Stop. Insufficient lifeboats due to pompous certainty in man's infallibility. Stop. Microcosm of larger society. Stop. It is believed at this time that upwards of 1,500 passengers aboard the metaphor may have perished in the imperturbable liquid immensity that, irrespective of mankind's congratulatory progress, blankets most of the globe in its awful dark silence.
The Titanic story, according to The Onion, graphically illustrating as part of its spoof history, Our Dumb Century, the journey from the specific to the abstract. The Titanic leaves our shores as a concrete, or rather steel, entity, only to meet an icy destiny which eventually became almost entirely metaphorical. Guy Deutscher again.
Yes, I think it is a good example, taking a very concrete concept, like a ship, and using it for describing various processes that take place in much more abstract worlds. Titans are these giants to start with. So the name Titanic is already metaphoric. And when we use it now as a metaphor for something else, it's a second level metaphor, if you want, for something even more abstract. I think it's quite often used also as a metaphor for hubris, things that go wrong because we're just too proud.
But metaphors come in all sizes, from the giant to the barely noticeable, from the freshly coined, and coining is a minty metaphor, to the dried and desiccated, which is a coconut-flavoured one. Take this sentence. To discover metaphors in everyday language is a thrill that drives me balmy with joy. I'm not being sarcastic. Chock full of metaphors, though, as Guy Deutscher points out, long-buried ones.
Exactly. It's all full of what I call skeletons of dead metaphors. They were once lively metaphors, but they've been dead for such a long time that their original sense has been forgotten ages ago. Practically every single word in the sentence is such a skeleton. So discover, well, actually, that's not quite as skeletal as the rest, but that literally just means remove the cover from. Thrill is a word that originally just meant pierce. So when you say I'm thrilled to bits, that literally just means I'm pierced to bits. That's a native English word. Discover is from Latin, of course. Balmy is also from Old English, and that originally just meant full of balm. Balm is the froth in the top of beer, whatever, or milk. And sarcastic is literally flesh-tearing. Sarx is flesh in Greek, and so it's related to the word sarcophagus.
So any attempt to clad these skeletons with the ancient flesh of their original meanings gets you nowhere. To take the roof off carrier crosses in everyday language is piercing thing that makes me frothy with joy, and I am not tearing flesh when I say that. Means nothing. We might just as well stick with the skeletons.
These are sort of skeletons that may be thousands of years old from different languages, especially from Greek and Latin in the case of English, that no one, unless they look at etymological dictionaries, would ever imagine are metaphors. But in fact, they're all skeletons of what were once very lively metaphors. You have corpses of metaphors, you have skeletons of metaphors, you have metaphors which are still alive. But ordinary language is no less dense with metaphors than poetic language. I think, in fact, possibly even more so.
So our language is a veritable Davy Jones locker of metaphor, metaphor upon metaphor. Come to think of it, language is a metaphor based on the word tonguing, and tongue itself, when used to mean language, i.e. a foreign tongue, is a metonym, a useful one-word metaphor, like the press, meaning people who work in journalism, or hitting the bottle, meaning alcohol, once closely connected. Oh, and if you're knackered from keeping up with all this carting about of meaning, knackered meaning tired enough in a horsey way to be worthless and ready to be destroyed and rendered into dog food and or glue, take a minute to relax. And as the minute waltz fades away, it occurs to me that if metaphor, dead and alive, is so ubiquitous in English, could we do without it? Supposing the forbidden trio of deviation, repetition, and hesitation were joined in the game of just a minute by metaphor. Supposing in that game you had to call a spade a digging implement. Would the judge's buzzer fade under the strain?
Well, I think it would just beep all the time. If you say that you're not allowed to use skeletons of metaphors either, then you really can't say anything. I mean, you can just grunt, and that would be the most you can say without using metaphors. And if metaphor had not been around, then we would never have progressed beyond grunts.
So, from the grossness of grunts to the pinnacles of poetry. Yes, Nicholas, you can stop that now. We've stopped playing. Thank you. Initially, it was held that poetic language was somehow simply language intensified by metaphor and formulated with the bells and whistles and the rhythmic drums of verse. And that may be true. Yet we've already seen how everyday language is already intense with metaphor, built on metaphor, cravenly dependent on metaphor to help us ease the passage between concrete and abstract ideas. Dr. Liz Barry, Senior Lecturer in English at the University of Warwick.
Poetic metaphors differ from everyday metaphors because there's often an element of surprise, even the sense that a rule's been broken or that a category error has been made. So it's not often immediately obvious, without the context of the literary work, how the metaphor is working, how we can talk about the subject of the poem in these terms. And some of the most conspicuous examples of this, of course, come from the metaphysical poets of the 17th century. So apparently outlandish or extravagant metaphors are used and can be the whole basis of a poem. In the most famous example, can two lovers be like a pair of compasses in Donne's A Valediction Forbidding Morning?
If they be two, they are two, so as stiff twin compasses are two. Thy soul, the fixed foot, makes no show to move, but doth, if the other do.
John Donne's lovers can be like compasses of the sort that draw circles or measure distances on maps, in the way they're linked, even when paradoxically separated.
And though it in the centre sit, yet when the other far doth roam, it leans and hearkens after it, and grows erect as that comes home.
Well spotted if you saw that the central compasses metaphor was a cartographical, possibly marine one. And stand by to abandon ship if formalism, modernism and postmodernism brings on a little queasiness. Because according to modern theory, poetic language isn't just everyday language with knobs on. Dr. Liz Barry.
The group of critics called the Russian formalists in the early 20th century, people like Viktor Shlovsky and Boris Eichenbaum and Roman Jakobson, argued for the distinct nature of poetic language, argued that literature's job was to defamiliarise its subject matter, that poetry was performing a kind of estrangement on its reader, making them feel that the world was alien to them for poetic ends. And this is often talked about in terms of violence. So Jakobson calls poetry organised violence committed on ordinary speech. That poetry manipulates ordinary language to make us strange, to make us notice it, and so concentrate on it and remember it, and to make language in this way more powerful. A metaphor is a very central part of that. And in modernist writing, the writing that perhaps fits best with Shlovsky and Jacobson's theory, takes the concept of estrangement or defamiliarization to new levels. You know, these writers are questioning fundamental categories such as time and space, in light of Einstein's theory of relativity, you know, nature of human motivation after Freud, and the idea of the unconscious. And a poet like T.S. Eliot revives the practices of the metaphysical poets, using apparently outlandish metaphors in order to disorientate the reader and make them think in new ways. Famously, in his love song of Alfred J. Prufrock, "Let us go then, you and I, when the evening is spread out against the sky, like a patient etherized upon a table." So bear that image of nature in terms of culture and not the other way round. Somehow expressing a moment, you know, this poem written in 1919, just after the First World War, where humanity's relationship with the world is complicated, is threatened by modern advances. There's a question being asked about human reason, human progress, and the world is sterile and passive, you know, etherized upon a table because of an over-reliance on reason and a lack of faith and spirituality for Eliot. So using these very disorientating metaphors to make us think about the moment and the way in which people were feeling about their world and human society at that particular point in time. Time is perhaps the hardest concept of all to understand, and perhaps that's why literature has been so absorbed by it, so exercised by it, has tried so hard to give us ways of understanding it. But modernist writers, post-Einstein, are living in a world where the idea is even more complicated, that the categories of time and space have, to some extent, collapsed into one another. In a writer like Samuel Beckett, there is an explosion of metaphors of time, new metaphors of time, time behaving in ways in the subjective perceptions of his characters that we've never seen it behave before. Time piles up, time thickens.
Although it could be argued that making you think in a different way, even where time is concerned, is just what everyday metaphor does. And metaphor in everyday language gave us, according to some, a kind of introduction to the space-time relationship long before Einstein. Guy Deutscher.
Think about it this way. If I say that a long time has passed, in fact, I've used two metaphors, because time cannot literally be long or short. It's not a piece of string. We've used a description from space and have applied it to this abstract notion of time. And when I've said time has passed, that's also a metaphor, because what really passes is a train or ships at night, not time. Time doesn't literally go somewhere. So it's not just that we need metaphor from space to talk about time. We actually need it to think about time, because we have no other way of conceptualizing it or visualizing it. We talk about the future being in front of us, but the future is not literally in front of us. The person is in front of us, just like the past is not literally behind us, because literally it's a shadow that's behind us. We can't say that language has discovered the concept of space-time exactly in the sense that Einstein used it. That would be a bit much. But certainly language has discovered the intimate relation between space and time thousands of years ago.
No time to discuss metaphor and modernism, Einstein and Eliot. Let us go down to the sea again and join plain old HMS Metaphor, where, we must remember, we were surveying the sea as a source and shaper of language. Here's maritime historian Michael Maxton with a geographical allusion.
If you like, this ratio of population to coastline is colossal compared to most other countries, if not any other country. A huge number of Britain's inhabitants were one way or another connected to the sea.
And if you have a nation that has absorbed cultural influences by sea from very many different cultures, then it may well be that the range of metaphors, the range of cultural metaphors, is much wider than in other languages. It may well be. This is just a guess, yes.
And let's stay with that satisfying metaphor of a coastline and add a geolinguistic one that explains how language is shaped by being transported from the physical to the abstract.
I talk about this flow of metaphors from concrete meanings to abstract senses. And in that flow, the metaphors are gradually eroded of their original force and sense and are deposited gradually, and then layer after layer, language grows. What starts as large, pointy rocks, these are fresh images and fresh metaphors, are gradually ground down by use and overuse and end up as the sand that we all step on when we speak in everyday language.
Πόσα πράγματα έχετε μέσα στο σπίτι, είναι three-bedroom house, για να κανονίσουμε...
Even Dora Constantinou, as she organizes another shipment of furniture from Greece to England, can instinctively see how long buried meanings can relate to everyday language.
Yes, deep down, there might be a connection, yes. Deep down, there might be a connection with metaphors, with transport. Yes.
Part 3. Stephen Fry takes delight in the uses and abuses of quotations.
The inspiration for this programme came from a white van with the words, "Stop me for a quotation," written on the side. Perhaps you've noticed the same thing. But have you ever been tempted to stop the van and ask the driver for a quote? We did exactly that in Romford.
My name's Jimmy Dean. I work for Traditional Windows. I've got to tell you now, for 20 years we've been driving around with that and nobody has asked us for a quotation. Never, never, ever, ever. Do you want a quotation? A horse, my kingdom for a horse.
This programme is about quotations. You know what quoting is, don't you? Ambrose Bierce did.
The act of repeating erroneously the words of another, usually dead.
Quote, misquote, you might say, because that isn't actually what Bierce wrote. Not quite. He forgot to add the last two words. But paradoxically, if I had quoted him accurately, then I would have been doing him a disservice, wouldn't I? But for the next 25 minutes or so, what we shall be concerning ourselves with is other people's words and how we use them and misuse them. But there is no doubting that we do use them. It's a huge industry. For the use of a quote lends the user an illusion of authority and finality. It brooks no swift rebuttal, unless the rebutter is Swift, Jonathan Swift. Try to raise a doubt, and it's not merely questioning the user, but tantamount to heckling Mark Twain or Shakespeare or Marcus Aurelius. Such lèse majesté is simply not acceptable in polite society. And even though we may appear to have little respect for authority, we do seem still to respect the quota and the quoted. But to begin at the very beginning, as Dylan Thomas wrote, or perhaps it was as Julie Andrews sang, what makes a quote? Who decides? And on what basis? Professor Des McHale of Cork University is one such cultural arbiter. He has compiled more than 20 dictionaries of quotations of one sort or another, possibly best known for his series of humorous quotes, Wit, More Wit, Still More Wit, and so on. How does he know what he's looking for?
I don't like a quotation that you have to sort of explain in a footnote, which is half a page long, exactly what the context is and who said it. It really should stand alone and be freestanding, and that's a skill in itself.
But then there must be some limit, perhaps, as to its length.
I think a quote has to be exceptional to merit more than, let's say, 50 words. I think people get bored if they're listening for that long. And, of course, Mark Twain said, the ultimate thrill in German is waiting for the verb. And I think you don't want to be waiting for the punchline for too long. I would reckon about 14 words is ideal. Now, at the other end of the scale, you might ask what a short quotation is. Can you achieve some end in just a very short quotation? I don't think you can do it in one word, but you can do it in two. And some examples are Miss Piggy's famous pretentious, moi, or Young saying childhood decides, which is a very profound thing to say in just two words, or Sartre's hatred fatigues. So you probably get away with maybe just a noun and a verb, but to put a whole philosophy or a whole sermon, as it were, a whole idea into two words is a very, very difficult thing to do.
Brevity is one criterion, to be sure, for an apt quote often aspires to the condition of poetry and its beauty and succinctness. But if we are quoting, then should there be at least some obligation on us to be accurate about it?
To quote something absolutely perfectly correctly is very callous, and I never like to hear. I always like to hear just the odd little word going wrong somewhere, because it means that the person has remembered it and hasn't looked it up. And if you see a quote being perfectly quoted, it probably means that the person actually went to a dictionary of quotations and looked the whole thing up. And Oscar Wilde didn't say, but probably should have said, no gentleman quotes correctly. And I think that's the way to do it. Example, Shakespeare, you know, is famous for saying, all that glisters is not gold. And everybody says, all that glitters is not gold, which, you know, maybe slightly better. I have no hesitation whatsoever, especially for my books, in changing a quote to make it freestanding, to put words in that weren't there so that the meaning is clear. But I think you can improve on a quote.
Now, you may think this to be a somewhat cavalier approach, and elsewhere in the world of quotation there is more rigour, more precision, more accuracy, more pedantry. And as a Cambridge man, I should apologise for my descent into bad language at this point, but I'm afraid mention must be made here of the Oxford Dictionary of Quotations. Elizabeth Knowles is the editor of that ongoing project and is very clear about their function.
We are tracking the language. It's what Oxford does, it monitors language, and we try to reflect the quotations that people are using. Because it's the Oxford Dictionary of Quotations, it needs to take account, too, of the quotations that people have used in the past. The key thing that a quotation has to do is to have both individuality and universality. There is an individual voice. It reflects a particular response to a particular moment. It's what somebody has said or thought at a special time. But it can also be applied by somebody else. Somebody else hears or reads those words and thinks, that says exactly what I want to say now. And that's why it lasts.
But don't run away with the idea that Oxford and Cork are in fundamental disagreement. Des McHale tries to spot something he thinks might or should be quotable. Elizabeth Knowles simply makes her decisions one step further along the chain and records when something is already being quoted. And surely both share a degree of omnipotence in being able to confer a kind of immortality upon those they grace with their gift of inclusion.
You always try to do that on the basis of usage. You're not sitting here in a sort of godlike way saying, I am going to appoint you and I'm going to appoint you. You're looking at the language and you're looking at what is being said and what is being quoted. I think one of the interesting things about quotations is that you can't in the end predict what is going to last.
Who would have thought, for instance, that the following four words would earn their place in the Oxford Dictionary of Quotations?
He would, wouldn't he?
That remark, of course, made by Mandy Rice Davis during the Profumo scandal, when told in court that Lord Astor denied having had an affair with her.
I don't think anybody would have said, that is clearly going to be a quotation that everybody knows today. But it is. And it's a quotation that everybody knows because, again, it's very useful. Yes, it is particular to a moment, to a special person, but it's so useful. People say it. They use it as a response.
Yes, if Mandy Rice Davis had a pound for every time that has been used, she'd probably be able to buy out the entire Astor family. But then why shouldn't she be paid if others profit from her work? Novelists are paid if their words are used by others. Songwriters certainly are. Who owns a quote? Des McHale.
I think quotes belong to everybody. Presumably, for legal reasons, it's the person who originally says the quote, maybe the person who first writes the quote, but there's so many different media. Suppose you took up an idea that's in a quote. I think it's a legal minefield, and I don't think it's ever been tested in the courts. I hope it won't be tested in the courts, because I think it would hardly be worth anybody's trouble, but who would really go to that much trouble?
Presumably some would. So if you are trying to compile a book, then whereof one cannot quote, thereof one must be silent.
It seems you're not allowed to quote Wittgenstein, because I've read books on Wittgenstein and people say, we'd love to quote a Wittgenstein here, but we're not allowed to. Now, that's his executors, of course, and his heirs and whatever, but I don't know if that's a good thing. I think if you say something, put it in the public domain, and you're just talking about a short extract. Now, if I write a book of 1,000 quotes and somebody comes along and quotes 999 of them, I think I'd be annoyed because they're infringing copyright. But a single quote, which is maybe only 10, 15 words being quoted, really I don't think infringes copyright, especially if I've manipulated to make it sound exactly like I wanted to sound. But most people are very, very generous and like to it. And Woody Allen's a little touchy, I think, as well. But again, because I regard Woody Allen as one of the great, with Oscar Wilde, I regard him as probably the greatest and most quoted person. Anybody who said, my troubles all started when I went to a school for mentally retarded teachers, I think is really very funny. Or, not alone is there no God, but try getting a plumber at weekends. You know, I mean, these are marvellous, these are wonderful quotes. I think, though, people people do like to, if they make a quote, they do like to see their name beside it. You know, it's only natural. Like an artist likes to put his or her name on a painting. They do like it to belong to them in that sense. And I think they should. Now, I'd very much like if somebody's doing a public speech saying, as Mark Twain once said, you know, and then they actually give the quotation. I think that is good. They're showing it's not their own. Of course, a lot of people pass off quotes as their own. And I mean, why shouldn't they? If they've bought the book, well, then it sort of belongs to them in a sense. But I think you'd probably know if I said something like that, that I wouldn't be good enough.
Does Elizabeth Knowles see that issue in a similar light?
Additional quotations is not an anthology of passages where you have gone through and selected representative pieces of somebody's writing. It is a collection of quotations, of things which people have quoted, which are on the move in the language. And therefore, of course, in one sense, whoever originally wrote or said the words is the author, with all that that implies. But certain words, phrases, expressions, sentences become so widely known, become so widely quoted, that they do take on a life of their own within the language. They may then be slightly altered. We get into the whole area of misquotations, which are a lot more interesting than just errors. They very often tell us quite a lot about how a particular person or an event is perceived. I mean, this is why some of the famously apocryphal quotations Marie Antoinette and Let Them Eat Cake, fairly generally known, I think, that no, she didn't say it, something similar was attributed to an earlier queen, but it survives because it has become a very useful shorthand way of referring to a particularly frivolous approach to a serious subject, and therefore it's used allusively. And I think it's much more interesting than just saying, well, of course, that's a mistake, she never said it. If you ask yourself, but why is it still used and remembered, you think, well, actually, it filled a linguistic gap. It gave us a way of encapsulating a particular attitude, which has been very useful.
Now the business of misattribution that was mentioned there. That's interesting. Clark Gable might be famous for having said, frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn, but he did not write those immortal words. Many are the actors, public speakers, and even comedians who rely upon others putting words into their mouths and are happy to go on taking credit, often in perpetuity, when the hack who penned the deathless prose languishes forever in obscurity.
The person who wrote the line gets very, very little credit indeed. I think, you know, well, they accept that as a fact of life. They take the money and run. But they must feel pretty bad when they see someone like Bob Hope getting a big laugh on the screen and they actually wrote the line. Although Bob Hope did integrate this once. He was caught with his pants down, as it were, and he didn't have a retort. And he said to the person who taunted him, he said, you wouldn't get away with that if my scriptwriter was there.
There may be a much more utilitarian explanation of who gets credited with quotable lines.
Whoever has written it, the particular person has delivered it. And that is the name the public are going to associate, and that's probably the person they're going to look up. So you need often to take account of what access you're providing people. You know, what names can they go to and find this?
But one thing we have not so far addressed. Who uses all those quotations gathered so assiduously by multitudes of collectors?
Jerry Seinfeld has a marvellous sketch where he describes people's main fears. Number two main fear in the world in the service seems to be death. Number one main fear is public speaking. So you would much prefer to be actually in the coffin rather than delivering the eulogy, it seems. And I think people need some help. That seems to be a main audience of people who buy these books.
So it is not merely those of us in the chattering classes who turn to the master wordsmiths of the past to bolster our public pronouncements, not to mention our fragile egos, it is everyone else as well. Who these days is immune from having to, excuse the expression and the split infinitive, deliver a presentation? Which of us can avoid sooner or later having to make a speech at a wedding, say? And what do many of us do? Unaccustomed as we are, if faced with the prospect, we look for help. We sometimes look for it from this kind of person.
My name is Lawrence Bernstein, and I'm a professional speechwriter. I'm approached to write speeches. It can range from diplomats coming to speak in the UK, right through to probably the most common, which is people's weddings. It would be an enormous generalization to say that every client wanted a quotation. However, the number who start off by saying, I would like to make some really funny quotes and throw in some very, very humorous references, are in the majority. One area that the whole quote, the use of quotes can go wrong is by overdoing it. When you get into your 16th Elvis quote of a 10-minute speech, then generally people are going to be yawning away in the corner.
Yes, we all have to face the fact that one generation has to give way to the next. And whereas references to Chesterton or Hilaire Belloc or even Morecambe and Wise might have set the table on a roar once upon a time, maybe it's time to roll over Beethoven and let today's celebrities take their place. And I use the word in its most despicable sense.
Noel Gallagher gets as many mentions now in the requests for a quote in a speech as, say, Mark Twain. In Oasis's Wonderwall, there is a line that all the roads that lead us there are winding. One other trend that I have noticed, and changing literally in the last decade, is a sense of inverted snobbery coming into both speeches and the way that people want to be perceived. And I think that perhaps characters who are not as accessible to a wider audience, who may have said the most fantastic things and put them in the most perfect and relevant way, are being avoided for fear of the speaker appearing too highbrow. I think we see this with politicians, and without naming names, I think it is very obvious that some of them do anything they can to dumb themselves down and would much rather quote, you know, a contemporary celebrity than they would a Cicero or a Marcus Aurelius.
And so we finally get to the politicians. What can I say about politicians that hasn't been said before? I don't even have to try. Here is Simon Hoggart, political sketchwriter for The Guardian, to do it for me.
Politicians these days don't quote very much. You never hear a Tory say, as Edmund Burke said, or even these days, as Winston Churchill said. Partly it's because they don't want to seem old-fashioned. There's a terror of appearing not in tune with modern times. What they want to do is create the quote, or as we call it these days, the soundbite, of which, of course, Tony Blair produced some classics like Education, 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 and an even greater classic, This Is No Time for Soundbites, I Feel the Hand of History on My Shoulder.
It's not a day for sort of soundbites, really. We can leave those at home, but I feel the hand of history upon our shoulder. I really do.
And presumably feel the hand of a writer over that shoulder spinning out the words being delivered. For we must face the fact that these days even politicians' words are often written for them by someone else, aren't they?
I know, it's a dirty little secret, isn't it? Some politicians don't write every word they say.
But nevertheless, our statesmen are just as anxious as ever to be immortalised in the dictionaries of quotations, aren't they?
Oh yes, every politician wants to be remembered for what he said. The trouble is, it's very difficult to get people to create lines for you to say. Most politicians aren't geniuses with words, they're no better than the rest of us, so it can be rather difficult and embarrassing. A classic example, Margaret Thatcher's speeches were to a large extent written by Ronnie Miller, the playwright, who knew other playwrights, so he gave her the line from Christopher Fry based on his play The Ladies Not for Burning, and she then said, you turn
if you want to.
Got a huge cheer at the time. She didn't want to say it because she wasn't interested in drama and she didn't know about the Christopher Fry play. So it's a classic example of it being imposed on her.
The ladies not for turning.
It's one of the very few lines from a recent politician that actually has gone down in recent history because it can be applied to almost any situation. I'm not for turning. You turn if you want to.
I feel it would be remiss of me, while we're on the subject of quotable politicians, to let the occasion pass without paying tribute to a giant in the field, and in the house, and in the restaurant, and in the bar, the mighty John Prescott.
Bear in mind that something like 70 to 80% of the actual demand are single-parent households, or single youngsters, or people who are living in a single house. Can you do that again? I made that crap.
A lot of his remarks may have been apocryphal, but they're still very funny. They got attributed to him because he was Prescott. The Green Belt is a Labour policy and we intend to build on it. getting after a bumpy aeroplane flight, he allegedly landed and said, "It's great to be back on the terracotta."
Which opens up a whole new area for us, because so far we've been talking about people keen, desperate even, to be remembered for what they have said. But there are people desperate not to be remembered for what they have said. One group of people stands out in this respect.
The score there, Southampton 4, Brighton 2, which is exactly the same as last year's result when they won 3-1.
Yes, the sports commentators have earned themselves a significant place in the history of recorded words by getting the words wrong. They indeed have a whole series of dictionaries devoted to their blunders, which even has its own generic title.
So I'm Barry Fantoni, and I've edited Coleman Balls really right from the start. The funny thing is that I can remember the first one. Somebody sent a letter in saying, I heard on the radio somebody say, and there was an athlete's name mentioned, this athlete is now in the kind of league of Wikipedian dispute, who it actually was, and actually said it, but he opened up his legs and showed his class. And Patrick Marnham was editing the letters page, and he said, this is interesting. Put it in and see if we get any response from it. And sure enough, within a couple of weeks, other people had started to spot commentators making a hash of things. They were all by David Coleman. He won't like me saying this, but they, in fact, were by him. And so we called it Coleman Balls. And then it grew. It grew from that period onwards.
And for those of you watching in black and white, the pink ball is just behind the green.
The earliest forms of Coleman Balls, and my favourite form, is still the ones in which metaphors are mixed.
Many clubs have a question mark in the shape of an axe head hanging over them.
I think the big guns will come to the boil.
And the Bulgarians are doing all they can here to waste every last inch of time in this game.
That's another nail in his afternoon.
They've toasted the other side of the coin on so many occasions.
They are staring down the barrel of a wooden spoon.
I bet Keegan will be jumping like a jack in a beanstalk.
It was the game that put the Everton ship back on the road.
It was a very hot potato at the time. We thought we'd put it to bed, but to have it regurgitated now is pointless.
There are thousands of dictionaries, compilations, anthologies, collections and selections of one sort or another offering selected quotable extracts. Why, there's even a regular programme devoted to quotes right here on Radio 4. Put the word quotes into that well-known search engine and you will be presented with more than 278 million website options. What the internet is famous for, pornography, garners a measly 22 million. The public demand appears to be insatiable. So we're dealing with something ubiquitous. If you want quotes on one-legged black lesbian motorcyclists who play Mahjong, then the chances are there is a website for you replete with quotes on that subject. Don't get me wrong, I'm not against one-legged black lesbian motorcyclists who play Mahjong. After all, some of my best friends play Mahjong. But the phenomenon is phenomenal. Is it to be explained in terms of security in a postmodern world where everything is contingent and relative, so constructing links to other living dialogic threads woven by a Bakhtian socio-ideological consciousness around the given object of an utterance and becoming itself one of the voices anchoring us to a coherent chain? Or is it to be explained by the fact that there's money to be made out of it? Dr. Steve Smithson is Senior Lecturer in Information Systems at the London School of Economics.
Oh, there must be money made, definitely. I mean, as far as I'm aware, it would seem to be through advertising. Typically, people who are looking for literary quotations need them in the context of giving a presentation or a lecture, and there's that notion of appearing to be erudite, well-informed, well-read. So in a sense, the website has the ability to offer advertisers this fairly large audience of, you know, ABC1 type consumers, and advertisers who wish to access that audience, there must be money in it, yes.
It was Homer who first pointed out that the World Wide Web is now available on your computer. Homer Simpson, that is, of course. But do these websites of endless quotations on the most abstruse subjects deliver the goods when compared to the traditional methods?
I was interested, especially in comparing websites with printed books. And so I took, purely at random, I'm not even sure if it is a literary quotation, but I used Truth is Stranger Than Fiction. And I searched I think it was five websites with that quotation. The first four didn't find it at all. And the fifth one, it did actually find four relevant quotations. Two of these were from Mark Twain, and one was from G.K. Chesterton. Interestingly enough, I also took four printed books of quotations and did the same search. Three of them didn't find it, and the other one did find it and attributed it to Lord Byron.
So is the most important thing about a quote who originally said it? Whatever is being said has probably been said before, and you can probably find it in the Bhagavad Gita, or by Suetonius, or Aristotle, or Marx, Karl, or Groucho, take your pick. We should not be surprised at this. Elizabeth Knowles of the Oxford Dictionary of Quotations certainly isn't.
Similar ideas come up across the centuries, and they're not just plagiarism. Sometimes somebody will deliberately quote. They'll quote because they want the resonance and the echo. But I think it's fascinating when you find that somebody in the 20th or 21st century and somebody in the 18th or 19th is saying something very similar, often because they're in circumstances which relate. But you can almost hear people talking to each other across the centuries.
Great thoughts can sometimes transcend their thinkers, or not. Des McHale.
Maybe I should let you into a trade secret now at this stage. If I make up a quote myself, I make up some quotes myself, not all that many, per book maybe one or two, but I never put my own name on, because if you put your name on, it's a bit like saying, I made up this marvellous joke a few minutes ago, no one's going to laugh. You say, I heard this one from a fellow in the pub the other night, and then you have a chance. But if I make up, I have a sort of pseudonym that I use, right? So I made up the pseudonym, I won't say what it is, but I put that in the book. If I have a few good thoughts, I'll put maybe two or three in per book. But then I find that pseudonym in lots of other quotation books in the next year or two. So I'm flattered in a way. I know they've been reading the book, but I know that my books, and if I'm going to use somebody else's one, I'd probably put that in person. Remember, people like me, jokers, joke book compilers, quotation writers, let's be honest, we are inferior personalities. There is something wrong with us, I should be saying this, or we wouldn't do that, wouldn't have this activity. Because in a sense, we're trying to impress other people by our tremendous knowledge or ability. We're not terribly creative people because we've made up very few of the jokes ourselves, you know. So, I mean, we are actually peculiar people, and therefore we wouldn't be doing this activity if we weren't. So that's to be taken into account all the time. You are dealing with strange people who feel the compulsion and need to gather up other people's witty remarks or whatever and put them in book form, put their name on it to impress other people. Now, that's a bit pathetic, really, isn't it?
Forgive us our petty vanities, and forgive us for omitting your favourite quote or any other shortcoming we might have displayed. We've merely tried to explore a few of the byways of the subject for your delight and edification, and if we've failed, then take solace in the fact that, as the man said, if something is worth doing, then it's worth doing badly. Thank you for listening. I wish you the goodliest imaginable day, and you can quote me on that.
Part 4 of Fry's English Delight. Stephen Fry lets rip with a sideways look at cliché.
Now, of course, you wouldn't catch me dead using a cliché, except, of course, for knowing ironic purposes. But let me get straight to the point, as Shirley Bassey so memorably sang. Cliché is part of language. Regrettably unforgettable, and often unforgettably regrettable, it grows like Topsy, ineradicable, and probably indefinable. Writer and language expert Julia Cresswell.
A cliché is effectively whatever anybody says is a cliché. It's almost impossible to define clichés. That itself is a cliché of writing on clichés.
Julia is author of the Penguin Dictionary of Clichés, although the book has been given a brand spanking new makeover, as we'll hear in a minute. But it is true to say she is a cliché collector. Tough job, but someone's got to do it.
I wanted to write a book about the history of the weird and wonderful expressions we use. A cliché is something automatic, like something that's printed out in mass form over and over again. But one person's cliché is another person's everyday turn of phrase or colloquialism or idiom or quotation. One of the things I think that makes an expression a cliché is if it effectively does your thinking for you. And this, of course, is what politicians exploit, it's what advertisers exploit, and it's what bores drive you mad with. And one of the reasons, I think, why we use clichés is actually they're very efficient. This is particularly obvious if you look at the sort of clichés that are used by journalists or politicians. So they say a lot more because of their social associations and people's experience of how they've been used in the past. They build up to very effective ways of getting at your emotions or channeling your thoughts in certain directions. People get so worked up about clichés and think that they're bad when perhaps they're not necessarily all bad, and certainly they do give us a history of our culture. Some of them are extraordinarily old, some of them very new.
And almost all of them are borrowed, and some of them, to continue in Julia's poetic vein, are blue. Goody. First, though, a definition from Dr. David Penfold of the School of Printing and Publishing at the London College of Communication.
Cliché is a term that describes the manufacture by printers, probably starting in the 18th century, of a version of type which allows them to use this cliché over and over again to keep printing. It's a version of cliqué, so it means to click. I'm not quite sure whether it was clicking into place or the sound of it, but it came from the idea when the French, presumably, used papier-mâché to over the type, which had been set, and then they formed a mould, and then into the mould they created a metal reproduction of the type. So it was no longer movable, it was fixed then. So like this one here, this is a curved one, but you can see the same principle, that the type's been set. And so you then have something which is no longer movable type, but it's something you can keep reproducing, which is hence the cliché.
It actually comes from a French verb meaning to click, and the correct English translation of this is stereotype.
And you can see why stereo, because the type actually stands out because it's three-dimensional.
Now, often derivations aren't worth the paper they're printed on, but in this case, the fact that cliché starts life as a printer's term, a forerunner of cut and paste, a way of preserving and regurgitating freeze-dried phrases, is worthy of note. So a stereotypical phrase, infinitely reproducible at the click of a printing plate, and later the click of a mouse. In the days of movable type, individual letters made of metal, the very physical ingredients of bespoke words, had to be treated as a finite resource, treasured. So, a cliché was a handy cut-out-and-keep, one-click affair. No compositing, no thought, no tying up of language into anything original. The very definition of cliché is coined by people for whom words are a stock-in-trade. So, I blame the media. Cliché dates back to 18th century printing, but the oldest cliché in the book is older even than that.
The oldest cliché in the book is hither and thither, which perhaps is a bit dated now, but it has reason to be, since the earliest example I found goes back to 725 in Old English, which is not the only Old English cliché, actually.
But is hither and thither a cliché? Does not its great age and old-fashioned vocabulary exempt it from the lingo bin? I mean, if you're going to turn round and say clichés are in the eye of the beholder, then we're going to be all over the shop.
All over the shop? No, I would call that slang, perhaps, rather than a cliché.
All right. One man's cliché is another man's... No, that's no good. Look, if we're not helped by derivation or definition, let's tap into a consistent source of cliché.
Consistency over the rest of the season, this is the main thing, taking one game at a time and being consistent.
So we just got to be very careful and take each game as it comes.
And it is true to say, literally, that is a game of two halves, and both halves the ball didn't run our way.
Obviously, I'm over the moon, it's finally happened, but...
I felt very upset for Dennis in many ways, because being the pro that he is, he could only give of his best, and when he came off, he looked absolutely...
Yes, we know how he looked and how he felt. Not nice at all, Cyril. I think I've got an idea. Let's take this big old cliché and spread-eagle it, to mix an avian metaphor, on our operating table and subject it to remorseless examination. Find out just what makes it tick. Nurse, the screens. But first, the story so far. The year is 1908 and Tottenham Hotspur players were among the passengers on the long voyage home after a successful tour of Argentina.
And on the way back, they came by sea. It's a very long journey. And to break the boredom, the squad, amongst all the rest of the passengers, were invited to take part in a fancy dress competition.
This is Martin Cloke, football enthusiast and co-author of the Spurs Miscellany.
And the fancy dress competition was won by two members of the Spurs squad dressed as Man Friday and Robinson Crusoe, complete with, on one of their shoulders, the ship's parrot. When the ship got back to England, as recognition of the fun that they provided, the ship's captain presented the Spurs team with the parrot. So the parrot lived at Spurs ground, White Hart Lane, for the next 11 years.
So far... so what? We have to wait till 1919 and the reorganisation of top-class football depleted by World War I losses. News came to Tottenham that the team would not qualify for First Division status. They'd been cheated, allegedly, of their rightful place at the top table by North London Arrivists and Woolwich refugees, Arsenal.
There was some lobbying done by a guy called Norris, who was the Arsenal chairman and a bit of a kind of local businessman and bigwig, who had apparently been having various conversations with the football authorities and persuaded them that they might want to do things differently, because he'd just moved his team from South London up to Spurs territory in North London. Spurs' place was taken away, and Arsenal, who had finished in sixth place in the second division, were given Tottenham's place. And on the very day this happens, the parrot, which had been presented 11 years before, died. One of the nicknames for Arsenal amongst Spurs fans is the Parrot Killers, but it's very likely that the phrase sick as a parrot actually comes from this stage. So obviously the parrot would need to have been sick before it died. But what we do know for sure is there was a parrot, we know where it came from, and we know that on the same day, a remarkable coincidence that Spurs were cheated out of their place in the First Division, the parrot died. So if that's not a good reason to be as sick as a parrot, I don't know what is.
An admirable anatomy of a pestilentially successful cliché from Martin Cloke. True or untrue, it taps into the mythic Roman notion of augury. The health of birds, usually judged by the state of their entrails, had a close relation to the workings of destiny. And in this phrase, the footballer empathises with the doom-laden and nauseous bird. Is this myth the source of its enduring power? Its popularity was established in print.
The first recorded use, according to sort of modern folklore, if you like, of the use of sick as a parrot was in Private Eye in the late 70s in the famous FC Neasden reports, Sid and Doris Bonkers and all that. And sick as a parrot was used in inverted commas. I also know that the sports writer Frank Keating claims to have invented the phrase when working on a local paper in Gloucestershire in the 70s. Apparently his sports editor was a fellow called Parrot, who was nicknamed with great originality Polly. So lots of people claim to have been the first to use it, but the earliest connection we can find is the famous story of the Spurs parrot dying in 1919. I think the original phrase was the sick as a dog, and also sick as a horse was popular in the 1880s, which is quite strange because apparently horses can't vomit.
Although a vomiting horse, one might imagine, if you want to imagine such a thing at all, betokens a horse on its last legs. And we shall return to animals, dogs included, later. First, though, spare a thought for the parrot dodger, the serious sports writer. Amy Lawrence writes on football for The Observer.
Of course it's a cliché trap, because there are so many times when you sit there and you think, I remember going to watch Chelsea in recent years under the Jose Mourinho era, where every game was exactly the same, and every game was Chelsea not trying that hard because they didn't need to, but being incredibly functional and a bit better than the opposition, and very seldom getting out of first gear and just having enough to win 1-0 or maybe 2-0, because by then the opposition had given up and Chelsea couldn't be bothered to actually turn on the style. And after the 13th game of the season that you've watched Chelsea at home play exactly the same way, literally people are sitting there in the press box tearing their hair out thinking, can I not use the intro for this match that I used in the West Ham game because it's identical? You know, just change the scorer and you've got the same story. And literally sometimes the manager would come and you think, please say something interesting, because you just want a take or an angle that can give you something new and fresh. Because when you are, you know, on repeat effectively, it doesn't go down that well with the editor. So you obviously have to try and find something bright and amusing or slightly less cliché-ridden than the last time. The internet has become a real added problem to us poor hacks, in that where once upon a time we might have had a little bit of time to play with before our deadline, now we're expected to write instant copy. So therefore, you know, our lovely opportunities to sit and gaze at the stands and rub our chins and ponder for some marvellous turn of phrase or metaphor is a bit out the window, to coin a cliche, because we're just as up against it as the TV commentators, and now we just have to respond instantly with the first cliche that comes into our head if needs be.
Like the printing press before it, the internet has reinforced the power of cliche. Collector and author Julia Cresswell's collection was turned upside down by the arrival of the information superhighway.
I originally published a straightforward dictionary, listing the clichés, defining them, giving examples, giving their history. But this was before everyone got broadband. Nobody really buys reference books nowadays, or very many fewer than they used to. You use the internet. There are lots of good online dictionaries. You can get the whole Oxford English Dictionary online via your library. So commercial considerations come in here. You have to have value added, a USP. You have to think of the bottom line. So there's a big trend in publishing now that all reference books should be narrative rather than quick lookup books. So I thought I'd organise the material thematically and take, for instance, clichés from food and cookery. So you could have done to a turn, small potatoes, bite the hand that feeds you, bite off more than you can chew. Then we had to decide what to call the book. And we couldn't call it a dictionary of clichés anymore. So we had to think of something snappy and attractive. Initially, we were going to go with The Best Thing Since Sliced Bread, which is a pretty good title, and I was perfectly happy with that. But it's a very difficult title to do a cover for. A picture of a loaf of bread, sliced or unsliced, is not going to be very attractive. And then the designer came up with an absolutely irresistible cover illustrating the expression cat's pyjamas, and it was just too good to waste. So that's how the book ended up being called The Cat's Pyjamas, the Penguin Book of Clichés as a subtitle.
And we've built a veritable Noah's Ark of animal clichés: incontinent woodland bears, non-vomiting horses, often of a different colour, nauseous psittaciforms. Many were invented quite consciously.
The cat's pyjamas was just one of many of these weird expressions used to mean excellent. The bee's knees is the other one that survived. It dates from the 18th century, but it was used in a slightly different way. In the 18th century, the bee's knees was used for the smallest thing imaginable. So maybe this had sort of filtered down and was in the back of someone's mind when this trend started. In a world full of flappers and Model T cars and jazz, reaction against everything that the pre-First World War stood for, when modernism was all the craze, there was a trend for making the most elaborate expressions you could think of for excellent, mainly formed from combining an animal with some odd body part. The cat's pyjamas clothing, okay, but mainly body parts. So you have the bee's knees.
The eel's ankle.
The cat's whiskers.
The flea's eyebrow.
The canary's tusks.
The snake's hips.
The bullfrog's beard.
The elephant's instep.
Anything that you could think of. The elephant's pyjamas even has been recorded.
The sardine's whiskers.
And it was just a clever, supposedly witty way of saying good.
Delve gently inside the cat's pyjamas and we'll find, waggling provocatively, another animal neologism meaning good, for which a preemptive apology might be in order.
The dog's bollocks. I wish I could get my head round where dog's bollocks, sort of the imagery behind it. I've argued it's because if you walk behind certain types of dog, like a boxer or a bulldog, the body parts are certainly outstanding. It's a phrase whose history isn't really fully chronicled yet. Most people think it comes from Viz magazine, but it was around before. In the sense that we all know it now, meaning excellent, it's been picked up by the Oxford English Dictionary a couple of years before it was used by Viz. But there's an even older use that was picked up in the 1940s, and it was a use by printers who had a slang term, dog's bollocks.
This turns out to be a rare example of a vulgarity and a piece of jargon and a slang term and a cliché and a pictogram. David Penfold of the London School of Printing.
The dog's bollocks, which is a colon followed by a hyphen, is interesting because it was very popular at one time, but nowadays I don't think you'd find a publisher's style that would include that. It just wouldn't be acceptable. It's used in some languages. I mean, the French use it a lot, but in English, you won't find that colon followed by a dash that printers used to call the dog's bollocks used any longer.
Not only did this, or rather these, fall into disuse in the closed world of printing, it didn't work very well in everyday speech.
The problem with this was because it got shortened to the bollocks. But the problem is, if you're saying that's the bollocks, meaning that's really good, it's very easily confused with that's bollocks, meaning it's rubbish. And I think that's probably led to it dying out.
The world's first self-cancelling cliché. But, dear feedback, why, oh why, is that nice Mr. Fry stooping to such low allusions? Point taken. Let's go upmarket. Sports writer Amy Lawrence says tellingly about the repetitiousness of putting into print accounts of even the best football.
It's like going to see Hamlet every week, twice a week. OK, there might be a different actor playing Hamlet, and obviously there's a slight difference in that the result might be slightly different from one Hamlet to the next, but essentially you are seeing a similar script time after time after time. So therefore, there are only so many ways you can describe the ball hitting the back of the net. There are only so many ways you can describe a fantastic right-footed cross.
And there's only so many ways of saying to be or not to be. Catch 22, really. That, by the way, is a reference to the paradoxically existential dilemmas of Shakespeare's Hamlet and Heller's Yossarian, and a reference to the fact that a brilliant, life-changing line of poetry or novel can, by dint of association football-style repetition, have a simultaneous life as a clunking great cliché. And it's enough to make you want to draw a little moustache on the Mona Lisa. It really is. Cliché collections in one form or another have been amassed to serious effect by the great lexicographer Eric Partridge, the 18th-century satirist Jonathan Swift, and the novelist Gustave Flaubert. Dr. Liz Barry is senior lecturer at the University of Warwick.
The critic Hugh Kenner writes about Flaubert, as he writes about later writers like Joyce and Beckett, and calls them Stoic comedians. They're commentators who are looking at society and thinking about the dilemma of writing in an age of a print culture where everything that one says has been written somewhere before, where literature is distributed immediately to the masses. The problem that Roland Barthes, the critic, calls déjà lu, not déjà vu anymore, but déjà lu, already read. Everything that one says has been already read somewhere. And how does the writer respond to this situation? And one thing that these writers are exploring is the way in which their characters are trying to live their life by the cliches that they read in books. They're trying to apply these received ideas to the world. And there's always a gap. They never quite fit. Their experiences never quite fit to the experiences that literature tells them about. So Madame Bovary is destroyed, you know, psychologically and literally in the end by the fact that her love affairs don't match up with the romantic cliches that she reads about, that she can't reproduce those experiences in her own life. Flaubert's very aware that the writer isn't immune to cliché, so he writes about the way in which writers are afraid to open his dictionary in case they find their own words or what they thought were their own words there. Or he comments on the way in which the banalities that he collects amusedly in his books, he actually also finds in his own love letters to Louise Collet. So he's very, very aware that the writer in some sense is in crisis in not ever being able to produce the perfect new idea. I think that we hear the dead hand of the printing press in language. As we know, the etymology of cliché is connected to the sounds that the printing press makes, the click that the printing press makes.
Like I say, I blame the media. All clichés, poetic and otherwise, start life as metaphors. And according to linguist Dr. Guy Deutscher of Leiden University, metaphors either get ground into common or garden anonymity by repeated use, or repetition popularizes them and turns them into long-lasting cliché.
So the reason why clichés remain clichés and great, rather than just being ground down like most common metaphors, is that they were so powerful, probably, to start with, that they refuse to biodegrade and they just pollute the landscape, like the big lumps of plastic that pollute the beach.
But if these nasty-looking lumps of plastic can be recycled in a really clever way, if they have a second life as art, how do we rate them? Tell me, where is fancy bread, in the heart or in the head? Famous magical lines from the casket opening scene in The Merchant of Venice. Too famous, perhaps, for James Joyce's Bloom, the advertising man in Ulysses, whose head is teeming with this kind of stuff. He can't resist a recycling opportunity, and he already has fancy and bread at the back of his overdriven mind because of the enchanting smell from a local bakery. This is his instinctive pun about his own fancy and where it is bread.
Tell me, where is fancy bread? At Rourke's the baker's, it is said.
A pun, a slogan, a satire on slogans, a satire on 20th century culture, an image from inside a man's head, a nifty bit of Shakespeare recycling. Dr. Liz Barry.
Joyce is playing there with a Shakespearean illusion, but also showing us how Bloom makes his own meanings for Joyce as well. These very constrained and very debased kinds of language are brought to life again and given all sorts of significance in his writings. In one sense, he's not frightened of the circulation of these meanings, because in the rich and rather crazy world of Bloom's head, the associations that they will have will be completely unexpected and completely individual and personal to Bloom. So there is a way in which the individual citizen can resist the kind of homogenizing influence of advertising, you know, wanting to make us all the same, wanting to make us buy the same product at the same time every day or at the same time every week. The big question about cliché, perhaps, is that it questions the distinction between the highbrow and the lowbrow. For Joyce's Bloom, the allusions to Shakespeare and the advertising jingles are on a par in his mind. They've become detached from their context. They're circulating in his mind. They're chiming off all sorts of things that he's encountering in everyday life. So there's a question about how one preserves the idea of high culture, and this is a question that's exercising the critics of postmodernity. How does one preserve a distinction between high and low culture if the idea of originality is no longer as powerful as it once was, if there is this anxiety about everything already, the already read, everything always having been read before? How does one create that or preserve that distinction between the high and the low? And does it matter?
Does it? Search me. They always say, though this is a bit of a cliché, radio has the best pictures. So, think Andy Warhol's self-conscious cliché, the repeated silkscreen print of Marilyn Monroe. Click, click, Makes you think, eh? Or not? Did any of this matter, or was it just an excuse for me to say bollocks a lot at the end of the day? There, I've said it. I've left it till the end of the programme, if not the day. Britain's favourite or least favourite cliché.
Fry's English Delight was presented by Stephen Fry. It was produced by Nick Baker and Ian Gardhouse at Testbed Productions for BBC Radio 4. Fry's English Delight is published by BBC Audiobooks.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this programme.